Pushkin.
Welcome back to Broken Record and part two of our interview with Questlove. I'm Malcolm Gladwell. Rick Rubin and I didn't expect to sit down with Questlove as long as we did, but after he told us in part one about how he wooed D'Angelo into collaborating with him, we just had to have him sit at the drums and show us how he did it. And then the stories kept flowing, including the best Obama story ever. Here's part two of our interview with Questlove. You mentioned way back when that you played D'Angelo that little bit that lured him in. Mm-hmm. Can you play that? We have a drum set over there. Can you reproduce that?
You... Yeah, sure. I'll give you an example.
Okay.
Is there a drum key though? Yes, there is. Okay, so the thing is that by that point in 1996, I was very guarded of my kind of strict, disciplined, quantized drumming because I didn't want anyone to think of the Roots as lesser than a hip-hop group. So for me, I had spent 5 years to that point being the most disciplined, lifeless drummer. You know, like my version of drumming was just to play the most disciplined. No dynamics, none of those things. So the difference is in seeing D'Angelo and knowing what language he spoke, I wanted him to know I spoke that language too. Previously, I was speaking the language of hip hop, which was just like. But once you see D'Angelo in the audience, suddenly this slightly becomes like somewhere between 4/4 meter and 12/8 meter. And if I really want to. If I really want to exaggerate it, it's kind of like my version of Thelonious Monk's talking about atonal, like the notes in between the notes. And
it's like a broken drum machine.
Yes. And the worse I played, the more excited he got. And that's the thing, like to do this, like you have to put your ego aside because every drummer was about Evel Knievel. Like gospel chops. That's the thing with drummers. If you go to gospelchops.com, you'll see some of the most amazing drum players that would put Neil Peart to shame, like that sort of thing. But playing with him, there was a song on his first album called Dreamin' Eyes of Mine, in which at the time I asked his producer, Bob Power, did you guys like break the drum machine or something? Because the way that it was programmed, this is how that song sounded, which made me knew that he spoke that drunk language. His programming was like. Which, once Bob convinced me, like, no, we did that on purpose. Then I was like, okay, I think you're just saying that. But then once I heard Wu-Tang Clan, in which the RZA sort of does that with his production, but I kind of feel like it's the accidental tourist, like, oh, dog, that's hip-hop. Like, I programmed it offbeat, like, you know, that sort of thing. Once we got to that place and that level, then I just, okay, this is the new language. I'm going to throw away everything that my mom and dad put me in school for. And I'm just going to drum like a 5-year-old from now on. But really, it's just being human. That's all I consider it, you know?
When you were playing that way for D'Angelo, so he's in the audience and you're watching him while you're doing this.
He stood up and pointed. Either he pointed or gave me like the Black Power fist sign, like, yo! The sentence was, yo, that's my drummer, or that's my brother, like. I had to let him know, I get you, I underestimated you, I'm sorry. I'm trying to be down. I speak the same language too. And he got it. He got it in that moment.
Yeah. I love that so much.
I think if you didn't have the training that you had in the precision before, you couldn't do the drunk style as well as you did.
You're right. I don't recommend people, and you know, that's kind of crazy you say that, because even now young drummers are on YouTube going to the top of Mount Fuji to learn the fanciest thing. And I tell them all the time, like, you got to go to first grade first. You don't start off getting your doctorate. My dad was a notorious, he loved that whole James Brown, I'm fining you $5, $10 for that role. You know, my dad's doing oldie stuff, so basically all of his stuff is all the same, like. And in my head, you know, I'm doing this at 12. And I'm having a conversation with myself like, okay, if I do a clean fill, maybe he won't fine me $20. So then I got away with that. And then when the bridge comes, then I'm like, okay, I'm gonna do something like. And already, 10, 20, up. I'm back here. Like, he will not, my father did not hesitate ever to just, he wouldn't even look at me. You just look at his right hand. And if he flashed a 5, 10, 15, 20, that's where I really got my disciplined chops from, not wanting to have my salary at the end of the night.
Thank God for your dad.
Yeah, man.
After the break, Questlove talks about his tenure at The Tonight Show and how it's improved the Roots as a band. We're back with more Questlove.
I was talking about playing drums. Can you practice too much?
You want to know something? Here's the thing. I don't practice enough. When the Roots first got The Tonight Show, like the first day where we had to sit in front of each other and rehearse, that was one of the hardest musical moments of my life. Like, I actually stopped rehearsal after like 3 minutes and called my manager like, yo, it's kind of weird, man. What do we do? Because literally, we've had a relationship as a group for 18 years where it's just like sound check, 3-hour show. We never rehearsed. So to be facing each other and trying to figure out how to be creative was so hard for like the first 2 weeks. And then we got over that quickly. And then noticed like, oh, we're really good songwriters together. Because previously we were doing the White Album thing. Like, okay, here's my song. Let me hear your song. Yeah, I got a bridge for that. Let me hear my song. So now, like, we're writing songs together. But then it's also being in those close quarters enabled us to actually be friends again. Great. One of the weirdest things I saw, we opened up for the Chili Peppers in Italy at a soccer stadium in front of 90,000 people. And there was a part after the third song on the show. Those four got in a magic circle. Like, Chad came from behind the drum set, and they all came in a magic circle. And I was like, okay. The audience is cheering, and it's like 3 minutes, and then they go back. By the fourth night, I was like, why don't they just have a set list? So I went to Flea, and I was like, yo, what do y'all talk about when y'all get in that circle? He's like, oh, man, we're just like, we're grateful, man. I was like, what do you mean? He's like, dog, we're just an LA band, you know, in front of a soccer stadium of 100,000 people, man. I said, oh, you're not talking about the show or anything? He says, nah, man, we're talking about like dinner that night and remember that riff we did in rehearsal? Like, we just take 3 minutes out to be grateful for this moment. So then I went back to my manager. I was like, yo, they're not even talking about anything deep. They're just talking about that. And he's like, oh, that makes sense. I was like, that's not silly to you? He's like, well, yeah, they like each other. You guys don't like each other. And that hurt me so bad. I'm like, we like each other. He's like, dude, you have a Slytherin and a Gryffindor bus. You guys traveled separately. You don't talk to each other, da, da, da. You got to be friends in order to get that sort of magic back. And then seeing them do that, then that really retooled our relationship with each other. And then the third part was that
just personal rehearsal time. Like now that we have a steady job, and I almost feel like I've robbed our fan base for 18 years because I've learned so much in these past 10 years of doing the show that I didn't know. Got educated on how to make music, how to be a band, how to be a better musician in these past 10 years that I didn't know between 1992 and 2008, which is weird.
Amazing. It's amazing.
I'm not giving back refunds either.
It's funny when you say that about the Chili Peppers in the circle. It's like you said they weren't talking about anything important. They were actually talking about the only thing that was important. Had they only been talking about the show, it wouldn't have mattered. You know, they were interested in something higher, let's say.
Yeah. I didn't realize it at the Beautiful. Time. I get it now, but I didn't realize that then.
Talking about the show, who comes to mind of a musical artist who's been on the show who completely blew you away and it really caught you by surprise? Unexpected, mind-blowing.
Hands down, I did not know how powerful Bruce Springsteen was. At the time, I believe he was celebrating the anniversary. It wasn't the river, it wasn't Nebraska. Because the night belongs to us.
Incredible.
Maybe it was Darkness on the Edge of Town. It was one of his albums that he was celebrating like the 30th, the 35th anniversary release of. He had asked the Roots to kind of amalgamate themselves into the E Street Band. So he had the super group. I mean, we could have just burst off into orbit. The energy, I've never seen anything like that in my life. And then that night he played the Apollo Theater. He literally climbed the scaffolds, like the wall, like Spider-Man. He climbed up the wall of the Apollo Theater to the top tier level. I only seen Fishbone do that, like climb. And I was just like, I have no energy. I've never seen energy like this in my life. And then watched him at Madison Square Garden 2 days later. Like I was an honorary E Streeter for like 2 weeks. And I was flabbergasted that all that greatness I'd known about and really didn't investigate and really regret it. But playing with him was amazing. But I mean, every act that's ever been in existence, it is such a bucket list moment for us. But
what did you guys play? Do you remember? With Springsteen?
We did Because the Night Belongs to Us. And then the second time he came back to the show, we did The Wild, The Innocent, The E Street Shuffle, which he invited all 400 members of the audience to rush the stage.
Because why not?
It was the NBC security was like, no, but you know, it's the greatest job in the world. And people always ask, like, you tired of it yet? You tired of it yet? I mean, not every day is the 4th of July, but there's a takeaway. There's something exciting. And it doesn't even have to be music. I'm doing stuff with Steve Martin and doing sketches with Martin Scorsese. There's always something that's entertaining. Like I realize now, and it's weird, like from the age of two, when my parents conned me into the music business, every aspect of it, until I became their band leader at 12, I didn't realize that this is the job I've been training for. Like in my mind, I'm like, okay, I'm going to start a band and then we're going to win Grammys and play this place and that place and sell out this arena and that. And that's not even half of it. All the knowledge and the wisdom that I have of music gets utilized in the show. So I love it.
We'll be back with more Questlove after this break. We're back with more from Questlove.
How has your taste in music changed from the time you were a little kid?
You're wide open. Lately, I've been exploring the stuff I shouldn't have been listening to. But it's like, okay, I'm a member of a Columbia House Record Club. Why did I get Debbie Gibson's Out of the Blue album? The critic in me now, like once I discovered Rolling Stone, then suddenly I became like a rock snob critic. And I know buying those record guides and whatnot. But I'm like, yeah, Christine 16 was the first Kiss 45 I ever brought. I love Kiss Meets the Phantom. And then only reading on later that, oh, that was their jump the shark moment or that sort of thing. And I mean, I know all opinions are subjective critically about acts and whatnot, but as far as like how I listen to it, it's weird now. Like, I wish I could. I mean, the way that I'm describing getting an orgasm from music, that excitement, it doesn't happen so much now because, you know, I believe that songs that you consider good, songs that you consider bad, but then there are songs that you know are effective and not effective. And especially as a DJ, that world always conflicts with me. So songs that I wouldn't normally listen to in my spare time, I know are crucial and work for me well at DJ gigs. And then there will be songs that I'll play at a DJ gig in which I know I'm going to lose the audience by more than half. And I'm still committing to it because I feel that.
What's a good example of something you?
One, I'll never play a Roots song. And the first time we ever went to North Carolina, like the DJ, like, oh, we got the Roots in the house. There was like one clap. And then he put the song on and the dance floor absolutely cleared. And, you know, rightfully so, like there's no establishing of the one. You can't have any type of funk music or any soul without the establishing of the one. Like, we were playing everywhere but the one. It's like, now I'm interested in telling stories when I DJ. So I plan these meticulous, scientifically proven, it's like a beautiful mind. Like, I'm doing these math graphics of the song's in this key, and okay, this is an E flat, and then the Beatles modulate to D, and then I could put Human League after that. Da, 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 da. So that's how I craft my DJ gigs. Now, to give you an example, I did the gig of my life, a 6-hour DJ gig in Central Park for the Hamilton after party for the Tonys. From 11 p.m. till 5 in the morning, I was God. Every song was perfectly segued, was in the right key. It told a story. People would write me letters. Oh my God, there was the most life-changing display of music. You went from Kermit the Frog to da-da-da. And I did everything. Anything with music, from Benny Goodman on down to Drake, from 1930, I covered it. And they ate it up like nerds. I did the same shit at the White House 2 days later for Obama's last night in the White House.
Oh, that's that famous party.
Fail. Oh, yeah, it was. So 2 hours into it, he taps me on the shoulder. He said, hey, you know, you're doing a good job. I love the Donna Summer and the old school hip hop and the jazz. And but look at them. They want to have fun, too. And he's pointing to his kids. They're having a sit-in. They're having a sit-in. And they're just like looking at me like, nah, none of this shit works. And, man. So then I became the DJ I hated. I'm like Googling, all right, let me go to Spotify, see what kids are listening to, like that sort of thing. So I became that guy, the guy I hate the most. And then suddenly that night became Animal House. Uh-huh. Like, it was the most debaucherous, the most, I mean, I could describe the Smells Like Teen Spirit video to give you an but it was like that crazy. They consider it the best night they ever had in their lives. And I'm having.
I heard some story, possibly apocryphal, that involves Usher getting into it on the dance floor with
Barack Obama. Like they're dancing, like, and he's coming up to me like, play, do you have French Montana? And I was like, sir, I don't have the clean versions of that. He's looking like, we're all adults here. Go play it. I was like, sir, I'm not going to play Pop That Pussy, bitch. What you working with? And, you know, it literally, like, I'm Ulysses at Grant. All these presidents are like looking at me in the Hall of Presidents, shaking their head. Like, I will say that at one point, I was really depressed because I had planned to make my grand statement. They were going to declare a national holiday after me because I'm the feng shui DJ. Like, I knew I was going to get a MacArthur Genius Grant for this shit. And at one point, again, I'm like looking on the internet, songs kids like, and Springsteen walks in. And I'm telling you, it's you can't imagine a wilder, like, think of the Eagles backstage stories. Think of Freddie Mercury's Queen Jazz release album party, Tales. Think of Animal House. Yeah. Think of everything. That's how wild that party was. And Springsteen walks in, and instantly Patty's like, ah, we're going to party. He pulls him, mm-mm, no. And he looks at me. He gives me that look, and shakes his head a little bit like, I know you know better than this. And I felt ashamed, like, yeah, I'm sorry. I sold out.
Wait, why does the world's greatest set list not work at the White House? What went wrong?
So here were his words. I was on the verge of tears because I built this up to be like, this is going to be my grand statement. I've been waiting for 8 years to have this moment. And whenever you build something up in your head and it doesn't go out in your favor, okay, you're going to have a panic attack. And I knew I was going to have a panic attack. Yeah. So I was like trying to exit stage left and get out of there. And he's, no, 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 come back. And you know, they're all like, play more. And I got to go. And okay, thanks. So afterwards, I'm walking. He's like, so you have a good time? I was like, yeah. He said, no, did you have a good time? I was like, no. Yeah, it was cool. Because then I didn't want to make it about me. This is his last night. It's his night to get loose and everything. Yeah. Everyone's crazy drunk and all this stuff. This was his night. So I was just like, yeah, it was cool. And he's like, what's wrong? I was like, you don't want to hear it. I'm cool. He said, no, tell me. And he's like, all right, let me guess. You're like an artist. And you planned your grand artistic vision of how you thought the night should go, and it didn't work out. And you're overthinking it, and you're thinking that I sucked. And I was like, well, yeah. He said, so he tells me a story. He says, he talks about Charleston and the Dylann Roof situation with the massacre. He said he knew that 30 seconds after the shooting happened that he was going to have to speak at that funeral. So he had crafted. He had instantly knew. It's like, okay, I got to craft the speech of my career. This is going to be my profiles and courage. You know, that's not what you're going to get. So he says he has the speech of his life, like ready to go. He's been working on it, perfecting it. And he goes down to Charleston, South Carolina. And he knew 3 minutes into that speech, it wasn't going to work. And so he's like going in his head. He's like, I'm not reaching the people. And he's like looking at his people, trying to warn them in some sort of baseball signal that I'm going to go rogue and freestyle. And they're getting upset. They're like, oh, you're the worst when you go on your own without us approving the script. And he said, some just told me, Barry, start singing Amazing Grace. Then he starts singing Amazing Grace.
Incredible moment.
Right. And everything turned around. He's like, you know what I did? He said, I served the people. I saw that something was wrong. I figured, how can I fix this? I took a moment. I breathed, collected myself, and I served the people. He said, and what you did tonight, you saw that something was a little off, and you served the people. There's honor in that. You did the right thing. We had the time of our lives. You served the people. So you should be proud of yourself. Do you feel better? No, I don't.
I cannot believe you. You didn't give me any love.
As the way, no, I mean, it really messed me up. A majority of 2016, I rejected like 80% of the gigs. I was depressed. I was just like, if you fail at records, what good is your life? And then that's when I started my thing, like, well, I'm going to stop DJing at nightclubs and just do it for the kids. And hopefully when these parents bring their 3-year-old kids here, they'll see me the same way that I was doing on the block party. And, oh, I want to do that. That was my mission. But no, his wife asked me to curate her book, Becoming. Yeah. And again, they asked me to just put like 30 songs together. And I wound up putting 1,400 songs. They're like, Amir, we didn't ask for the story of my life, but we'll take it anyway. So, you know, I had to redeem myself.
Thanks to Questlove for kicking off our second season. You can go to brokenrecordpodcast.com to hear the songs discussed in this episode and in part one. Broken Record is produced by Justin Richmond and Jason Gambrell, with help from Mia Lobel, Jacob Smith, Julia Barton, Jacob Weisberg, and of course, Rick Rubin and Bruce Headlam. Our Broken Record theme song is by the great Kenny Beats. This show is brought to you by Pushkin Industries. I'm Malcolm Gladwell.